Welcome back to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I wanted to share an email from a listener in East Lansing regarding, I believe it was Wednesday's show, which included one segment in which we touched on the Jackson National Life Expansion in Aladdin Township. This was with Michael Finney of MEDC. And in another segment, we explored the Michigan Grand River Charette. This is the attempt to revision the 19-mile stretch of Michigan and Grand River Avenues from between Weberville and I think it's Laramie, Wyoming, with an eye to the future, okay, to sustainability, to accessibility, et cetera, et cetera. So we're talking about those two segments. Arthur Slaboski writes, Mark, did anyone else pick up the irony in the two features you had today? And one, economic development coming to sprawl territory, whose redeeming feature is that it turns over tax revenue to the city of Lansing via a 425 agreement. Convenient to commuters from all freeways, not connected spiritually or physically to any related businesses in the Lansing area. I might quarrel with you there, Arthur, because Jackson National does have a data center in the city of Lansing, but your larger point is still well taken. And 3 miles from the Charette Corridor. That's hand one. Hand two, a Charette to maintain the sustainability of our old, purportedly busiest corridor, where even the classic Amel's restaurant is hobbling along as if under court order to remain open. It's a complicated subject, but how can you hail both developments is beyond me. And then there's Eastwood. He continues, the mood of Lansing is like the two immigrants from the old country who found themselves on a train that just left Detroit. Immigrant one says to number two, number two, I haven't seen you in years. How nice to see you on my way to Chicago. Number two looks back at number one and says, how can we be on the same train and it's going to two places in two different directions? They both shrug, look at each other, and say, America, what a country. Arthur adds, one of my bike advocate buddies mentioned, and I agree, that we should at least see sidewalks and a bike lane built along Okemos Road from Jackson National Life to Jolly Road. Arthur Slaboski, thanks for the great email. And you can reach us with yours as well at currentstate@wkar.org. Onward into Friday's show, a new study released last month finds Asian carp may in fact be reaching the Great Lakes. The Asian carp is an invasive species with an appetite large enough to potentially decimate the food chain ecosystem of the Great Lakes. There have been many efforts to contain the spread of the fish in the Chicago area waterway system that connects to Lake Michigan. This new study now raises new questions about the effectiveness of that program. Dr. Andrew Mahon co-authored the Asian carp study. He's an assistant professor of biology at the Institute for Great Lakes Research at Central Michigan University. Welcome, Dr. Mahon.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining me, Dr. Tammy Newcomb, Senior Water Policy Advisor for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Dr. Newcomb, welcome to Current State.
Thank you very much.
We have heard a lot over the last few years regarding the Asian carp. Which of you is more qualified to talk about the features of this fish and describe its characteristics? Tammy Newcomb, want to take that?
Sure, I'll take a stab at that. So I'm going to break it down a little bit further. So what we're very concerned about right now are bighead and silver carp. And these two fish species, if you're familiar with native species, I combine them with, they're kind of like a Chinook salmon in the size they get to and the area in which they swim. They're kind of like a walleye in that they need large rivers to successfully reproduce in. And they're kind of like an alewife in how they eat. So they eat small zooplankton in the food chain. They reproduce at high levels and they have the ability to explode very quickly in their populations. So if you're familiar with native fish, combine the walleye, the Chinook salmon, and the alewife, and you've kind of got the properties of what we see in these silver and bighead carp.
And those are two species that are under the umbrella of Asian carp. I mean, Asian carp is the term that gets thrown around the most, but the bighead and the silver are two subspecies of Asian carp, correct?
They're actually two distinct species. When we talk about the umbrella of Asian carp, those four species, the other two that we're concerned about are bighead carp and grass carp. So we know we've got some grass carp out there in the Big Lakes, but they don't seem to have quite the same invasive qualities of the silver and bighead carp. And black carp are a species that is still further down the line in the Mississippi River. So the two that are most imminent and probable and of concern to the state right now is silver and bighead carp.
Andrew Mahon, describe how you and your fellow researchers approached this study. You used a tool called eDNA, environmental DNA. What were you looking for? Tell us about your methodology.
So we came online sometime in late 2009, early 2010, essentially to help management agencies look for these fish where they, you know, where the invasion front was. What the problem is catching these two species, bighead and silver carp, is extremely difficult. They don't bite hooks. Finding them when they're in lower densities is almost impossible. There's people that have gone out and, like, experts who have physically tied balloons with strings to the back of these fish and gone out and tried to catch them, knowing exactly where they are, and they can't catch them again. Even in areas in the Central Illinois River, which happens to be right now the highest density of these two species in the world, and there's numbers out there of somewhere in the multiple millions of these fish in a small stretch of river.
Wow.
They've done what they call mark and recapture studies, and they're catching less than a fraction of 1% of what they caught in the first place, marked, and then tried to recapture. So finding these fish at the invasion front was our goal. And, you know, I'm a genetics expert. That was my background. And essentially, Lindsay Chatterton from the Nature Conservancy and Chris Jurdy at the University of Notre Dame and I were sitting around talking, and we're like, well, how can we try to apply these genetic techniques to help with, you know, to be another monitoring or surveillance tool? So essentially what we use is standard genetic techniques that everybody's using. There's multiple faculty here at CMU. There's faculty at essentially every research university that are using the standard genetic techniques. We just applied them in a different way.
So you found genetic evidence of the silver in the big head?
Exactly. Essentially, you could turn on any TV show in the evenings, crime shows, what have you. They're using DNA to prosecute criminals. Asian carp are leaving DNA in the environment, just like I'm leaving DNA on my coffee cup right now. They're leaving DNA in their environment. The lucky thing is it's floating in water, so we can go out and collect that, and we can detect that, and we can use the techniques to say definitively that this DNA came from a bighead or a silver carp. Just like your products in the store, when you go to check out, have a barcode on them, DNA is like a barcode for species of fish.
Tammy Newcomb, how do you interpret that? Do you accept that, first of all? And if so, what's your interpretation of that?
So the first thing I want to say is the work that Dr. Mahon and his colleagues have done has been so important to us, because he's exactly right in terms of the difficulty to catch these fish. And when you think about a lake the size of Lake Erie, I mean, you could take, as an analogy, a 20-gallon aquarium, fill it full of water, put in a tiny water flea, put on some oven mitts, give yourself a quarter of a teaspoon-sized net, put on a blindfold, and try and catch that water flea. Okay, so that's essentially what we're trying to do when we're running around with traditional gear like nets and electrofishing, trying to find these fish in a large volume of water. So the work that they've done to detect these fish in low numbers with this very sensitive technique is so important to us. So when we got those positive eDNA results back in Lake Erie, as a management agency, we have to presume that means a live fish. Now, at the end of the day, you don't know it's a live fish until you have a live fish in hand, because there are some other sources. But for us, the most plausible rationale for how that DNA got there could be a live fish in Lake Erie.
What are the other possibilities, Andrew Mahon?
So there are other people saying, there are other studies out there that are looking at things like storm sewers, like potentially birds carrying the DNA, and potentially crop runoff that are using ground up Asian carp as fertilizer and things like that. But again, as Tammy said, it's absolutely what we've come to believe, and what we, you know, the data are telling us, the most plausible explanation is that there's live fish there. The thing is we don't know how many yet, and we're at the stage where we're starting to look at not just detection, but we're trying to start to figure out, well, how many are there?
Is there an indicator species, Tammy Newcomb, that you've maybe got your eye on here that would be that the big head or silver carp would feed on, that might be kind of a canary in the coal mine here?
Well, unfortunately, big head and silver carp feed on zooplankton, so tiny little things in the water. So they're competing with our native, what we call pelagivores, or those fish that eat the zooplankton in the water column. So they're not preying on other fish.
Okay. That is a very easy thing to confuse, because it's very easy to assume that they are preying on other fish, but they're just competing for the food source.
Exactly. And they get that big. I mean, they get greater than a meter long, up to 100 pounds just on tiny organisms in the water.
Back at the beginning, now this was found in Lake Erie, correct, Andrew?
They've caught big head carp in Lake Erie, I believe, in 1995 and in 2000. So it's been a few years since they've actually caught an actual a capture of a fish in Lake Erie.
And how is it? Where is it theorized those fish came from?
There's a number of potential sources that they could have come from. I don't like to speculate where they potentially came from.
Tammy, you want to speculate where they came from?
we sort of have to. So when you look at potential sources, one source would be the bait industry, potentially. But the other source, and the most likely source...
I'm sorry,
source,
the bait?
The bait industry. So So... the live food trade up until about 2000, I think it was 2002 maybe, was allowed to have live Asian carp in the markets in Canada and in the States. So the federal Lacey Act listed these fish as injurious, so they're no longer allowed in the live trade market. So it is possible that some of those fish got in there from that live food trade market as well. And because these fish are so long-lived, it is even possible that there are fish still out there remaining from those events. But again, we haven't seen an actual fish in Lake Erie since 2000.
How long is that? How long do they live?
Andy, you can back me up on this, but I want to say they're 10 to 20 years old. They can, yeah.
Absolutely, at least that, yeah.
Is the DNR proceeding, Tammy Newcomb, is the DNR proceeding as if fish are in Lake Erie at least? And what does that mean in terms of the road ahead?
Yes. So a couple of years ago, we put together a very comprehensive plan for what we would do in the event of Asian carps reaching the Great Lakes. And the first thing, our first effort right now is on that prevention. And that prevention for us means closing down those potential avenues for those fish to get into the Great Lakes. And really the number one way that we see is that Chicago area waterway. So our bottom line is hydrologic, ecological separation there. But the other things that we're doing is surveillance. So we've got some positive eDNA. That's a line of evidence that tells us there's a potential for live fish to be in Lake Erie. So now what we've done is we've increased the vigilance. We've got communication materials out. We've got identification materials out for people. So we're asking people to let us know what they see. We have an online reporting form for people who think they might be seeing an Asian carp. We always like the pictures associated with those reports. But then we also are working with commercial fishermen in the Lake Erie Basin area, and we're working collaboratively with the state of Ohio as well.
Andrew Mahon, what would it mean if a big head or silver carp were captured, if you actually captured a fish here for the first time in a dozen years or so?
It means that it's time to, continue the efforts that Tammy and Michigan and Ohio and even the federal agencies are doing. The earlier that we can keep these, that we can detect and keep these fish at lower numbers, the better it'll be in the long run. And prevention is the key right now, like Tammy said. You know, we have the eDNA as a tool. It's not a silver bullet, but it's an early warning tool. For helping us. It's the fishermen going out. It's the constant vigilance to help us keep these numbers low. If we can keep the numbers low of these species in Lake Erie, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, wherever, the better chance that we can keep them from having a huge impact. And we've already seen when they're in the river systems, particularly in the Illinois River, how much of a damaging impact they can have. So the earlier we know, the better, because it'll help. Like I said, it's an early warning tool.
But what I hear you saying is it's not necessarily catastrophic that there are that there is a small number of Asian carp in the Great Lakes. Am I right, Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not too late. As long as we, keep the vigil, like I said, as long as we're vigilant and everybody keeps working at keeping the numbers low, and I think we have a good chance to keep them from having a huge impact.
Tammy, what do you think the future holds here? Are you more optimistic or more pessimistic with regard to this battle we're waging?
I'm very optimistic because we have several tools coming online that can help us address both the surveillance aspect of it as well as the potential eradication if we need to. And Dr. Mahan's absolutely right in terms of let's keep those numbers as low as possible so we don't build up those reproducing populations. So I'm positive of that. We have some positive things going on with the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, where President Obama has given the Great Lakes a significant amount of money to help us in this battle against invasive species. It's other invasive species as well. So I'm optimistic that we can work with our stakeholders and that we have a plan to try and address this fish issue so that it doesn't devastate our spectacular fisheries in the Great Lakes.
Dr. Tammy Newcomb is the Senior Water Policy Advisor for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, and Dr. Andrew Mahan, up in Mount Pleasant, co-authored the Asian Carp Study. He's an assistant professor of biology at the Institute for Great Lakes Research at CMU. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. For 24 years, John Schneider's column was a destination read in the Lansing State Journal. John retired from the paper just over a year ago to free up more time for fishing and meandering in the woods, but it's been a thoroughly modern retirement. It's continued to include a blog and a regular column now with Bridge Magazine, and Current State has learned a periodic return to the Lansing State Journal. Welcome
yes,
to John Schneider. Nice
well,
to see you.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to see you, too.
So it's been a year away from the daily column. Has life been about what you expected, or has it been something different?
It's been pretty much what I expected and what I had hoped for. I'm enjoying the flexibility. It was always my dream to be able to fish for a whole summer up north, and I was able to accomplish that last year, so that was great.
What does that mean, fish for a whole summer?
Is that three months
of fishing weekend, every weekend or what?
Well, pretty much in the months of July and August, I fished almost every day.
Wow.
Sometimes twice a day.
A bad day fishing is better than a good day at work.
Exactly. I was pursuing salmon up on Lake Huron, and it
didn't encounter any big head carp by any chance.
No big head carp. Nothing actually jumped into the boat, which was good.
So do you have a routine then now, or is it a no routine routine?
No, I still I'm a creature of routine, so I still get up fairly early. I'm always out of bed by 7.
Wow.
So I can kiss my wife goodbye as she goes to work.
Oh, what a guy. What a guy.
And then I usually try to figure out something to do outdoors in the morning, whether it's cutting wood or lawn work or working on some sort of project. And then I usually spend the afternoon writing. As you said, I'm writing a column for Bridge. I'm blogging every day. Beginning next week, I'll start a weekly, it's kind of between a blog and a column in the Michigander section of the State Journal, which will be fun. And I'm also working on a novel, so I spend much of the afternoon writing.
So if theoretically you were 100% plugged in when you were writing the daily column, how plugged in are you now?
I'd say
10%.
Yeah, maybe 30%. If plugged in, you mean being
connected,
exposed, being accessible all the time. It's, you know, I still have carry on my cell phone. I've got my laptop, so I'm not entirely dark, but you know, I'm as plugged in as I want to be. Let's put it that way.
This novel idea sounds really intriguing. Has this been in the back of your mind for a long time?
Yes, it has. For you know, almost ever since I began writing, I've hoped that I would someday, you know, sit down and write a novel. I've written a nonfiction book that was published, but I still wanted to try the novel, and so this has given me that opportunity, and I'm about 35,000 words into it, and it's going really well, and it's been a very interesting experience. You know, some days it's like, you know, this is what I was meant to do, and other days it's like, no way this is ever going to work, you know. So it's which I guess is the way it should be.
I'm impressed that you saved the writing for the afternoon, because I always, if it really requires brain power, I'm one of those people that has to do it preferably in the morning. It's uh-huh. like my brain is nowhere near as sharp in the afternoon
well, yeah.
as it is in the morning.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because I remember when I at State Journal, I would get there early, almost before everybody else, and my most productive time would be in the morning, early
yeah.
in the morning,
yeah.
first few hours.
It's those thoughts you have in the shower.
Or yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. However, what I've discovered recently is that sometimes that physical work in the morning, cutting wood, you know, splitting wood, you know, it's kind of a time when your mind sort of goes into a cryogenic state, because you don't have to think about what you're doing.
Right.
It allows your mind to work on things that you're writing. So the two go together.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. I just wish the whole day felt like it did in the morning all day. I've had that thought many times.
You know, and on that point, interestingly enough, my son, son Benjamin, who is a songwriter with a band, I saw him quoted in a recent interview on the web about this thing, about this connection between his writing and his outdoor activity. You know, how he talks about how when he gets stuck or when he's trying to come up with a new idea, he'll go for a long walk. You know, he'll go up in the mountains, or he'll go camping, and somehow that experience aids his writing. Which, you know, maybe that's more common than I think, but I thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah. We're going to play a track here from Lord Huron. John's son, Ben Schneider, is a member of that band, which is really gaining quite a bit of notoriety. Can you tell us any more about the novel? Can you tell us about the plot at all?
Well,
are you comfortable going there or not?
Yeah, I'll give you a general idea. The storyline, the plot, is about a woman who, after being dead for a year, comes back to life, returns to Earth. And the story, the book will be about the world's reaction to that, the media, the clergy, scientists. It's like, you know, whether the world would be ready for such a thing, and how they would receive it, and what would be the upshot of it.
You mentioned cryogenic a few minutes ago. This conversation has an interesting theme to it here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good point.
Does the recent gig with Bridge Magazine and this renewed activity at the Lansing State Journal indicate a desire to get busier than you thought you'd want to be?
Well, it indicates a desire to earn money because my buyout at the State Journal, in fact, it wasn't actually a retirement. It was more of a buyout. The company that owned the State Journal, Gannett, offered buyouts for everybody in the whole company that met certain criteria, age and terms of service and et cetera. And so I took that, and my salary continued for 1 year, which recently expired. So I think I have to figure out a way to earn.
Interesting.
And, you know, and a novel is an awful big long shot. So, you know, I need some paying gigs too.
Tell us about your reappearance in the State Journal, though. When does that start, and what will you be doing?
Well, there's a section called Michigander,
which
you can get at the lsj.com/Michigander on your web, on your internet. And I'll be doing a weekly piece, somewhere in length between a blog and an actual column, just offering observations on life in Michigan. It'll be a seasonal thing where I'll comment on what's happening in the state at that particular time of year. For example, next week, Thursday, I'll be writing about, the spring ritual of opening up the cottage, after closing it up all winter long. People are now starting to think about going up and reopening it for another summer. So that's what I'll be writing about.
Yeah, we were talking about we're talking with John Schneider, late of the Lansing State. That's a terrible way to put it. Former Lansing State Journal columnist.
Columnist emeritus. How about that?
Columnist emeritus. We got a few reporters emeritus around here at WKAR. We mentioned your son Ben's musical career with his band Lord Huron. What has it been like to watch a creative enterprise like that?
Well, he went to U of M art school, which, to a parent is like, how about engineering or medicine or law? But he was always that kind of person who was going to do his own thing. So
actuarial sciences. How about that?
Yeah. So we supported him, and he graduated and went out to L.A. With his girlfriend and got a really good job as art director of a advertising agency and with full benefits and everything. And so great. And then he calls us up one day and says, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to go on tour with my band. So, it didn't totally surprise us because he's had a band ever since he was in high school.
Okay.
He went to Okemos High School, and they always were playing gigs at, little clubs, so forth. So, and by the way, he said, can I borrow $5,000?
Something's never changed.
Right. So we supported him. We said, well, you got to do what you got to do. And he said to me, Dad, I don't want to wake up when I'm 40 and regret not having tried this.
Oh, who hasn't heard that? Who hasn't thought that?
Yeah. So I said, okay, more power to you. And we figured it would be a three-month deal and he would come to his senses and beg for his job at the advertising agency. But as you know, it's taken off. They did the Jay Leno show. They've been getting really good reviews and, magazines like Rolling Stone. It's been great.
Here's a segment from Lord Huron that John tells us has an interesting story, so of course we couldn't not play it. This is part of a track called The Stranger. An opportunity to plug Lord Huron's appearance coming up in June, correct?
Yeah, at the Loft.
The Loft in June.
Yep.
Lord Huron. John Schneider is returning to the Lansing State Journal periodically. Find him at Bridge Magazine as well and his blog, which is at johnschneiderblog.com. johnschneiderblog.com. John Schneider, good to see you.
Well, thank you. Good to see you, Mark.
The summer movie season is upon us. In a few days, we'll be inspired by the feats of cinematic superheroes and clutching our seats in terror as we watch the world's demise. What a country. Current State's Emmanuel Berry joined John Serba, entertainment reporter and film critic for MLive and the Grand Rapids Press, to sort out the many films of summer. Serba said this summer will be similar to summers past.
It's kind of the same every summer. You've got at least for the past few years, you have a bunch of sequels and you have a bunch of superhero movies. And considering how successful Avengers was last year, I don't think we're going to see that stop anytime soon. So
now, another big superhero film that we have coming out this year is Man of Steel, the Superman reboot. So from the previews so far, it looks different than the last couple of Superman movies. It's a little grittier, I guess, and directed by Zack Snyder of 300 fame, produced by Christopher Nolan of the Dark Knight trilogy. How do you think this reboot's going to compare? The last one was kind of a flop. What do you see for this one?
Well, I think what they learned with the last one is that audiences want gritty. You know, look at how successful Nolan's Batman movies are. Look at how successful the rebooted James Bond is. James Bond is very brooding. He doesn't have the sense of humor anymore. So seeing Zack Snyder give Superman a darker edge, that's really no surprise. That's one of the bigger trends in movies in the last decade or so. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out. And notably, Henry Cavill, another pretty much unknown guy coming in and putting the cape on this time. So, you know, Zack Snyder can be, as far as I'm concerned, he can be hit and miss. I loved 300. I loved Watchmen, but Sucker Punch was a big bomb.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, my inner 14-year-old comic book nerd really looks forward to seeing what a new creative team can do with Superman.
Now, continuing on with this theme of darkness this summer, there are a lot of movies that are looking at the end of the world or how the world's going to end. And there's a lot of different ways that happens, apparently. We have lots of possibilities. One of those is World War Z. That's the film starring Brad Pitt, and I think it's a zombie. It's a zombie film, but from the previews, it's kind of hard to tell what is going on. You know when you typically see a zombie film, you see the gore and the, you know, the Walking Dead, but these just look like everything just suddenly starts falling over. I don't know what's going on. What do you have any better idea than I do about this film?
Well, no, I don't actually. But you know, it's based on the hit novel. And it stars Brad Pitt, and this is kind of a notoriously troubled production from all the reports coming out. But, you know, I think one thing that strikes me about seeing the trailer for it is it's a big scale thing, you know. It's CGI. It's waves and waves of zombies running and tumbling over all over each other. And that's a step away from The Walking Dead, which is blood and guts and gore, and it's, you know, prosthetics and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what zombie, what that niche of filmgoers likes, you know. So I don't know how this one's gonna work. I mean, it's definitely looks like it's made for the big screen, and it's gonna be, like I said, big, large scale stuff happening, but I don't know. I'm real skeptical about it.
Now, another way the world could potentially end is apparently giant sea monsters are going to rise and destroy us, and we're going to have to fight them off with robots. That would be the plot to Pacific Rim, which is by Guillermo del Toro, of the maker of Pan's Labyrinth, the Hellboy series. Are you looking forward to this one a little more than World War Z? What do you think?
Absolutely. You know, Guillermo del Toro, there's part of me that wishes he would do another Pan's Labyrinth, which was, really dark and haunting kind of unusual horror movie. And this looks like he's going to, he wants to do a throwdown with Michael Bay and Transformers and show him how it's really done. So I'm you know, because Transformers is a big, noisy, visual mess that series is. And so, you know, the thought of seeing men in giant robots battling giant aliens from the deep or whatever they are. Yeah, you know, there's again, that's the kind of thing that tickles your inner 14-year-old. and also fans of Sons of Anarchy will get to see Charlie Hunnam, who's the star of that TV show, on the big screen.
Now, the other kind of end-of-world movie is called The World's End, very different than the other two. This has Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright. You may know them, Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead. Not really the typical blockbuster end-of-the-world movie, but is it still worth a watch?
You know what? This is the movie I think I'd put at A number one as my most anticipated movie this summer. It comes out in August, and that creative team, Edgar Wright, the director, Simon Pegg, and Nick Frost, They do really entertaining, fun stuff. And this is, there isn't even a trailer out for it yet. So this is kind of just me reading a sentence online and going, I need to see this. It's about a group of friends who get back together after 20 years to do a pub crawl, a massive epic pub crawl that they did when they were younger. And when in the midst of it, the apocalypse occurs. So,
you know, you might as well be drinking if the apocalypse is happening. That's the way to go down, right?
Yeah, exactly. And seeing the kind of, you know, they did a great, speaking of zombie movies, Shaun of the Dead was a great riff on zombie movies. It was simultaneously a satire and a love letter. Hot Fuzz was the same thing for, like, cop dramas. And so I'm really interested to see what they have cooking for this new film. And it's actually getting a big push. It was a fall release originally. And so there wasn't, you know, so that kind of marginalized it. But once the finished product came out, the studio said, we need to release this during August, which is a step forward for it commercially. And it's coming out in July, right in the heat of the summer movie season in England, which is where they're from, obviously, the filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think this has a potential to be kind of a sleeper hit during the summer. We'll see.
There are also always busts during the summer. What do you think is the biggest movie that could potentially be a bust?
Well, in my mind, there are two, and one is After Earth, because, let's put it this way, I was in the theater recently, the trailer for this one comes on, it's got Will Smith, it's, you know, this is another post-apocalyptic
end of the world
movie,
yeah,
another end of the world thing. Jaden Smith, his son is in it, they play guys who, you know, 1,000 years after the world ends, they crash on Earth and they're stranded. And, okay, well, you know, we've kind of seen that premise, but it looks promising. And then what comes up on the screen is directed by M. Night Shyamalan. There were audible groans from the audience.
I have a bone to pick with that man about The Last Airbender. I'm going to send him an angry letter someday.
Oh, you know, and you thought he bottomed out a couple years prior to that with The Happening. No.
Yeah. Why do they let this guy keep making movies? No. But you think it's a potential bust? Looks high budget, low returns on that?
Quite possibly. But, you know, there's still a part of me that looks back fondly on Shyamalan's earlier films like The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable. This, the one thing this has going for it, and I don't know if audiences care or not, but I kind of do. This is not an original M. Night Shyamalan story. Will Smith came up with this story, had other people write the screenplay, then Shyamalan came on to direct it, and, you know, he tweaked the screenplay as they were working on it. So there's some hope there that Shyamalan will show the flashes, you know, because in the mid and late 90s, people were saying Shyamalan might be the next Hitchcock, you know. He's got a great, you know, great filmmaker sense for suspense. And but then he kind of squandered it. He has this kind of big ego, and people are starting to love to hate the guy.
Yeah, very
so,
very true.
Yeah, and the other another one that looks like a potential bust is The Lone Ranger.
And that has because, Johnny Depp in it, so
yeah,
he typically,
you know,
does pretty well in the summer, I feel, but
he does. But this thing, I don't know it. It's got a distinct eau de toilette to it when I see the trailer, and he plays Tonto in this, and Armie Hammer, who you remember from The Social Network, he plays the Lone Ranger, and I've heard so many people say why about this. I mean, who knows? Maybe. Younger audiences will like it. I don't know, but this one has a distinct potential bomb whiff to it. So we'll see.
Anything you think is going to be a surprise hit this year? Last year, Moonrise Kingdom kind of came out of nowhere, cute little quirky film. Anything else on your radar like that for this summer?
Well, Moonrise Kingdom, just to give you a little background on it, Wes Anderson directed it, and very quirky, and it's not a mainstream film at all, but for him to do $45 million at the box office like that did, that's a big deal, you know. And mm-hmm. and the year prior to that, Woody Allen's the Owen Wilson film, I'm blanking at, Midnight in Paris, that did really well during the summer too. So there is a niche for that kind of alternative market where people who want to go to the movies and are sick of being blown away by robots and superheroes. So there's a couple of them. The World's End has potential, like I said, to be a good breakout hit. Much Ado About Nothing is Joss Whedon, you know, of Avengers and Buffy the Vampire Slayer fame.
I would want to see that.
Yeah, exactly. That's getting some good buzz out of the film festival circuit. And it's a modern, you know, a modern take on Shakespeare, as I mentioned before. And another one that that looks pretty compelling is called The Bling Ring. And it's directed by Sofia Coppola, who did Lost in Translation. And it's a true story, well, you know, inspired by a true story about some teenage girls who use the internet to figure out when celebrities are going to be home or not, and then they break into their homes and burglarize them. And Emma Watson is in this, and I think Sofia Coppola is poised to have another breakout movie like Lost in Translation. It's been a while since we've really heard her name mentioned in any kind of significant context. So, and I think this is this might be her shot at being that kind of sleeper this summer.
Well, John, I want to thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you and helping us sort through all of these films. I have a better idea, I think, of what I want to see this summer. Once again, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem at all. And, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's so many movies coming out. You can't even wrap your head around it. You got to go week by week.
Yeah, you certainly do. John Serba works for MLive and the Grand Rapids Press as an entertainment reporter and film critic. Thanks again.
Thank you.
With springtime finally arriving in mid-Michigan, the sounds of the season have also emerged again. This northern cardinal song is one of hundreds of bird songs recorded by Dr. Pamela Rasmussen. She's assistant professor of zoology at MSU and assistant curator at the MSU Museum. Dr. Rasmussen's studies in ornithology have led to an authoritative reference work on the birds of South Asia and her involvement in the Avian Vocalization Center at Michigan State University. The Avian Vocalization Center, or AVICET, is an online database of more than 10,000 recorded bird sounds from more than 3,100 species. Pamela Rasmussen is personally recorded on all of the world's continents for this project. WKAR's Peter Wharf recently visited Rasmussen on campus to discuss some newly discovered owl species and their unique calls.
We were very fortunate to be able to describe two new species of owl in August. And this was a big surprise to me, as it was to everyone, because it's unusual enough to be able to describe a single species, but in this case we were doing a revision of this one, what was considered one species of owl in the Philippines. And as we got recordings and more information about morphology, but especially the recordings, we realized that these were distinct at the species level, not just at subspecies levels. And we knew for quite a long time that there were two or three forms that on islands that had never been described to science. We knew that they were morphologically a little bit different, but until we got the vocalization recordings, we didn't know that they were new species. And with owls, if they differ very dramatically vocally in what we call homologous vocalizations, then that's a very good argument that they're separate species, because these are birds that recognize each other vocally. And the differences, the vocal differences between these forms are astounding in some cases, and very good, very strong evidence for new species.
Will we be able to hear the new discoveries at the website?
Oh, yeah, they're on there. There's quite a lot of, yeah, you can hear them to your heart's content. There's lots of recordings, courtesy largely of one particular recordist, Rob Hutchinson, who lives in the Philippines now and leads tours there.
Fantastic.
One of our co-authors.
So you're saying we're going to hear some of the more extreme vocalizations of owls, you said?
Of these new owls. Basically, we divided what was a single species into seven, five of which had been described to science, but two of which had not. So those are the new species.
Great.
Okay, so this one, Ninox raii, is only found in the Sulu Islands, which we now have 23 recordings from there, but almost all are new as of last year, made by Rob Hutchinson. And we had an inkling from one poor recording from many years ago what it sounded like, but we weren't really convinced that that was even it. And now we know for certain. But Rob went there to make recordings, and he went with an armed guard because it's an area of insurgency. And a few weeks later, a couple of other birdwatchers from Switzerland went, and they were kidnapped. And they are still, I believe, in captivity.
Really? Where are the Sulu Islands?
These are the islands that connect the southern Philippines to Borneo, basically, but these are part of the Philippines. Let's play this.
An incredible sound. It's almost sort of a knocking percussive sound over that jungle background.
It's very, very different from any of the other owls in that group. And it doesn't even sound like an owl. So let me play you one of the other ones, one of the new species now. Okay, this is one of the new species, the Camigan hawk owl from Camigan Sur Island, which is just, it's a small island just north of Mindanao. And they're completely different on Mindanao, I might say.
A little more what we might expect as sort of an owl sound, but very strange.
And strange, and it almost sounds like a pack of dogs fairly distantly. They've actually been seen and videotaped making that sound, so there's no mistake about it. And let me play another one, the one from Mindanao, because that one is geographically, you can actually see the two islands from each other, and yet the birds are very different in many ways, but certainly not least of which is the voice. It's just only a couple of notes, but so even though these two forms, the Mindanao hawk owl and the Camigan hawk owl, are found on islands that are within easy sight of each other, they're so incredibly different, both in morphology and as well as vocalizations.
Can I ask you some of your earliest memories about being interested in birds and studying birds?
I was interested in birds even as a little kid, and I would always request that my mom take me to the coast, the Oregon coast, for bird watching, or Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in eastern Oregon. And I'd always have a list of bird books that I wanted her to buy for my birthday or Christmas. Yeah. Or I would always just be thinking about all the places that I would go when I go bird watching when I could, when I had my own car and was able to travel. So,
yeah. You wanted to travel to forests and jungles all around the world, and it sounds like you've accomplished that. Where are some of the most productive and fascinating places that you've been?
Oh, well, that's very difficult to narrow it down because it's the world is just full of incredibly fascinating places, and there are many, many, many wonderful places I've never been to. But, for example, Manu National Park in Peru, I've only been there 1 week, but there are over 1,000 species of birds in that one national park. You could spend your life there and never see all the birds that are there. It's just amazing. It goes from above timberline to every habitat in between down to lowland rainforest, and it's probably the most diverse place on earth for birds. But Indonesia, India, all these places, they're amazing.
Dr. Pamela Rasmussen is assistant professor of zoology and assistant curator at the MSU Museum. Dr. Rasmussen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Current State wants to pass along an interesting development today from our TV station. This morning on WKAR-TV's program Off the Record, our in-studio guest was Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson, a Republican. Mr. Patterson was being interviewed about proposed legislation on no-fault auto insurance. At one point, Gongwer.com reporter Zach Gorchow asked him about fellow Republican Jace Bolger's performance in his role as Speaker of the Michigan House. Mr. Patterson had this to say.
Well, what would your advice be to the Speaker of the Michigan House, Jace Bolger? You said earlier you weren't sure he was running the House very well. What would you suggest that he do differently?
You know what? Adolph Bolger, you mean? He's really become very arrogant, and he's throwing his weight around up there, and I think he's embarrassing himself. I don't think if he thinks he's going to be a candidate for governor, he better learn how to control his temper. He better learn how to work with the consensus within his own party. And I think sometimes Adolph steps a little bit to the fringe, and he's embarrassing himself. He's not, in my mind, going to be a candidate for governor.
And you can see the full interview with Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson, including his comments about Speaker Jace Bolger, on Off the Record tonight at 8:30 on WKAR-TV. Coming up on Current State next week, we'll speak with a local restaurant who's playing host to writer, chef, and TV personality Anthony Bourdain, and we discuss the legacy of Tiger great Hank Greenberg. That and more next week on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer, thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry as well, and Aaron Young for engineering. Congrats, Aaron, on your MSU graduation today. Student loan repayment time has arrived. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.